They knew only too well, of course, that the rule of the faggots was not consigned to the fanatical class. And ironically, Richard Carlyle himself recalled, quote, many a faggot have I gathered in my youth to burn old Tom Paine. The powerful reasoning of the faggot, in Paine's words, became a key trope in Infidel Discourse. Carlyle accused a society for the suppression of vice of atavistic malevolence. He said, you possess the same disposition as your ancestors who kindled the flames in Smithfield. And Carlyle's followers were quick to follow his example and assume the martyr's crown. Susanna Wright, for example, declaimed at her trial in 1822, we will brave the dungeons of the faggots. Vain shall be all your persecutions. By 1822, in fact, Carlyle claimed to have sold 20,000 copies of The Age of Reason, and added, no doubt optimistically, that some copies were being read by 50 families. And as a final note on this idea of the apostolic succession, Carlyle produced his own apostolic succession with radical pressmen. I don't think many of you should know about this figure, but people like James Watson, David Hetherington, and George Jacob Holyoake ensured the popularity of Paine for the Victorian period. For Paine, however, the faggot was not just an instrument of persecution, it was also the means of ensuring the religion's incredible aspect, in other words, its spectrality. The phrase, with the aid of the faggot, occurs in The Age of Reason in a passage in which Paine debunks the resurrection, calling it, quote, the story of an apparition, or a ghost, that's another quote, which, with the aid of the faggot, yeah, passed into fact and ensured that, quote, miracles followed on miracles. Such imagery of spectral procession is central to Paine's debunking of the fictions of Christianity, which he called the religion of dreams. In his role as a doubting Thomas of Deism, Paine dismisses the revelatory foundations of the Bible as a proliferating series of uncorroborated stories, hearsay upon hearsay. In fact, Paine is particularly harsh about the, quote, blasphemously obscene Annunciation. You know the Annunciation thing. He says, it gives an account of a young woman engaged to be married, and while under this engagement, she is, to speak plain language, divorced by a ghost. The language of spectral rape here, which draws, of course, on classical precedents of Zeus visiting mortal women, is echoed in Paine's attack on, quote, the adulterous connection of church and state, wherever it has taken place, whether Jewish, Christian or Turkish, and that's an obvious way in which Cruikshank is completely misrepresenting Paine here. Paine was against what he called national churches, wherever they existed. Such miscegenation of religious and civil power, in Paine's view, produces the phantoms of priestcraft. As he put it, priests and conjurers are of the same thread. Paine's debunking of religious illusion was therefore highly derivative, but he gave this critique a new twist, not just by being popular, but by bringing it up to date and comparing revealed religion to, quote, the new optical and mechanical deceptions of phantasmagoria. And he said this, there is now an exhibition in Paris of ghosts or spectres, which Goethe is not imposed upon the spectators as a fact, as an astonishing view. Now, several. I'll just have to shuffle around a bit here to try to get my. Now, several caricatures. As an arch skeptic, Paine insisted that The Age of Reason, therefore, have no place for religious or political conjuring, as he called it. But his enemies, of course, inverted this logic and made him the personification of all the ghosts and spectres of Jacobin terror, hence the title of my talk, Spectres of Violence. So, we start with the kind of procession images now. Several caricatures depicting Paine in league with the devil appeared in 1792, the year in which Paine was declared an outlaw. For example, thank you. Pain, sin of the devil, pain of course without the E, yes? Shows a monster with three heads, perhaps based on legendary Cerberus, who guarded the entrance to hell. And this illusion gives, it's in the centre is a devil with horns, on the left is pain shouting rights of man, and on the right, does anyone know who's on the right? I suppose you can see from here, can you? On the right is Joseph Priestley, yeah, shouting sedition. Above the horns are crossed daggers with the Jacobin inscription sign up. The text underneath purports to be an intercept of correspondence from Satan to Citizen Payne. The caricature clearly demonises pain, that's obvious, isn't it? But because it's using an older, allegorical tradition, I'm less interested in this, I appreciate it less, yeah. It doesn't mount a dramatic spectacle. It has less of what Derrida would call spectral political force in that sense. A more important genealogical source of corruption is this print. Sedition, levelling and plundering all the pretended friends of the people in council. Remember, this is also 1792, the year of the prosecution of rights of man. Now, this is another image of Payne and Priestley in league with the devil, can you see? But it's got a more naturalistic setting. It shows a table with three figures, say Payne and Priestley and the devil. The scene's bursting with emblems of insurrection. The devil is sitting on a pile of muskets, Payne holds daggers, sits on a sack of gunpowder. On the wall, there are prints of Jacobin executions, and behind both men are stacks of treasonable pamphlets and books. And below the print is a modified national anthem, which associates pain with the absolute destruction of the British way of life. I don't know if I should sing this, but I'm going to do that. Pain, thy mortal life, compound of fraud and strife, plainly declares, thy aim is levelling noble state, church and king. I won't carry on. Now, as this print was published before Payne had written Age of Reason, it's Priestley who represents the allegedly seditious delusions of rational religion, signified by the lantern he's got in his left hand. Now, in the hysterical counter-revolutionary climate of the 1790s, it was easy for lawyers to tar dissenters, not base or infidel, dissenters, with the violent Jacobin brush of anarchy and destruction. Thomas Rowlandson's 1790 print, Repeal of the Test Act, for example, shows dissenters as an anarchic mob intent on destroying the established Anglican Church. There's some resemblances here, aren't there? Is not symmetrical, however, as Crookshanks. The efficacy of this kind of genealogistic rabble-rousing can be gauged by the fact, of course, that only 1 year later, after this print, the church and King Mob famously destroyed Priestley's home in Birmingham. He narrowly got away, of course, didn't he? And in December 1792, effigies of both Payne and Priestley were publicly burned in Colchester, and I think other places. When Payne adopted Priestley's role, in a sense, therefore, as a tribune of freethought, he attracted the full force of this anti-dissenting sensibility. The Age of Reason, if you like, doubled his notoriety, as he now personified both religious and political revolution. This exponential leap in his terrorist credentials provides a rationale, therefore, for Crookshanks, seemingly hysterical depiction of infidelism as synonymous with national insurrection. By the way, I don't mind if you want to put the heater back on. It's a bit cold, isn't it? The heater back on.
It's
quite loud.
It makes a bit talk over it.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, I'll carry on. Yeah, you need to wear it. Okay. As noted earlier, the demonisation of Payne and the suppression of his works plays into the hands of radical martyrology, allowing Richard Carlyle to adopt the role of Payne's apostolic successor. But the temporary disappearance of Payne from the political and cultural scene after his outlaw, after the suppression of his works, did not mean the end of what Derrida calls spectral politics. And what I'm going to do now is just filling this gap. I want to propose that Payne's resurrection in the post-war period
Owed much to the fact, this is with the Stephen on the earth, by the way. Owed much to the fact that in his absence, the images of caricature were transferred to a new enemy, of course you know that one, Napoleon. With the advent of Bonin onto the political and cultural scene, the spectral habit of popular culture went into overdrive. In a rather remarkable pamphlet called Historic Doubts Relative to Napoleon Bonaparte by a man called Richard Whately, published in 1819, Whately argues that Napoleon was in fact, quote, a phantom conjured up by British ministers, end quote, to divert attention away from the failures of domestic politics. Moreover, Whately made a direct comparison between this phantom and biblical allegories. And he asked his readers to consider whether Napoleon, in fact, quote, performed all the wonderful things attributed to him. And I think Whately's incisive comments here were made at the end of a long period during which scores of caricatures depicted Napoleon as a phantasmagoric enemy in league with both death and the devil. Indeed, Cruikshank, George Cruikshank, confessed that he established his reputation by, quote, skeletonizing, skeletonizing Napoleon. Though, as I will show, Rowlandson, Thomas Rowlandson, was never very far behind. Now, so I'm going to show you a whole slew of these. They're great. I haven't got a chance to say a radio about them, I'm just enjoying this. Some of the wittiest examples of this debunking of Bonin's power begin with Cruikshank's comparative anatomy of Bonin's new conscripts, filling up the skeletons of the old regiments, and his triptych called Bonaparte, Ambition and Death. Clearly that title draws on Satan, Sin and Death from Milton, which was a very popular we already saw that with painting and death, This phantasm, so it draws on Satan and Death from Milton, this kind of movie. But skeletonic satire also tapped into the wider cultural revival of the Dance of Death. Now the Dance of Death from the medieval and late medieval period provided caricatures with a popular visual language for both social and political satire. The most subversive aspect of this original series, in my view, was its social inclusiveness. And its most radical images, or that could be appropriated for radical views, shall we say, showed death stalking members of the ruling class. Yeah, rich man. It was relatively easy, therefore, for caricaturists to replace the original generic victims of death with more recent political and social targets. For example, going back to the 1790s again, George Cruikshank's father, Isaac Cruikshank, did a print called The Moments of Reflection. Do you know who this is, by the way? This is Catherine the Great, And death is about to stick his dart, of course, into her head, And there are all her victims, Very, very boring. In the fantomal caricature version of Napoleon's career, death is Napoleon's constant companion, and their changing relationship is an index of the ups and downs of Napoleon's fortunes. In Rowlandson's The Corsican and His Bloodhounds at the Window of the Tuileries, looking over Paris, death is a close advisor. And this is one of my favourites. I can give a talk on this, or just on this thing alone. The Two Kings of Terror, this is November 1813, just after the Battle of Leipzig, death is a figure of nemesis. But the caricature narrative of Napoleon's career provided even more explicit precedent for the revival of pain. A slew of graphic satires published in the months around Waterloo, the months leading up to the Battle of Waterloo, portrayed Napoleon's return from exile as a diabolical resuscitation or revival of his power. Rowlandson's The Flight of Napoleon from Hell Bay, i.e. Elba, Hell Bay, a mock epic skit on Satan's epic journey out of hell at the end of Book 2 of Paradise Lost. Cruikshank's The Corsican's Last Trip, under the guidance of his good angel, shows a colossal Napoleon leaping from Elba to the French throne with the devil on his back. Cruikshank's Escape of Bonaparte from Elba, In this print, the means of escape from hell bay is literally demonic. As Napoleon sits on the back of a flying devil, followed by the mounted, carnivalesque figure of death doing a kind of jig, can you see it? Yeah? Kind of dance of death image. The culmination of this train was Cruikshank's, this is wonderful, I think, the Phoenix of Elba, resuscitated by treason of May 1815. This print invokes several 1790s precursor prints in which the radical movement necromantically conjures up spirits and demons of sedition. For example, William Dent's print, Revolution Anniversary, or Patriotic Incantations, shows a group of radicals, including, of course, the ever-present Fox, and also Priestley, dancing around the steaming cauldron from which emerge French spirits. In Rowlandson's A Charm for Democracy, a similar cauldron is being fueled by a huge pile of radical tracts, including several on deism. Cruikshank's reworking of this necromantic spectacle, therefore, in The Phoenix of Elba, clearly anticipates the Age of Reason, as it shows a central faggot, or fire, surrounded by impending scenes of destruction. When the defeat of Napoleon was securely banished for a second time, of course, to Elena, Cruikshank produced his most famous print, Boney's Meditations on the Island of St. Helena, the devil addressing the sun, which once again casts Napoleon in the role of Milton's Satan. He's repeating the soliloquy from the opening of Book 4 of Paradise Lost, which funny enough I'm teaching my first years tomorrow, so I'll probably show this image. Though the print, by the way, is ostensibly triumphal, I still think this kind of colossal Napoleon is a sort of edgy thing, it's kind of edgy tribute to it, yeah. Sort of brooding figure. The period between this propaganda offensive against Napoleon and the eruption of Peterloo and the radical activity of 1819 the post-war period was short, just a few years. And it's not difficult for caricaturists, therefore, it was not difficult, for them to replace the enemy at the gates with the reconstituted threat of the enemy within. The anti-Jacobin demonisation of the resurgent radical movement was therefore simultaneously nostalgic and familiar. The retargeting of the skeletonic satirical armoury of the Dance of Death, for example, can be seen most spectacularly, of course, in Cruikshank's Death and Liberty, or Britannia and the Virtues of the Constitution in danger of violation from the great political liberty. Radical Reform, what a great title. Published, incidentally, almost simultaneously at the same time as The Age of Reason, Cruikshank was phenomenally busy at this time, 1819 to 20. Death here is no longer the handmaiden of Napoleon, of course, but has become a fully revitalised, regrouped and rapacious internal threat. Death's attempted rape of Britannia, by the way, this also recycles the 1790s. In which William Pitt is trying to get hold of his money, is a hyperbolic spectacle of national crisis. Britain's future is in the balance, and the catastrophic consequences of the triumph of radicalism are represented by the infernal retinue sheltering under Death's cape. Can you see all that? Those monstrous demons, yeah, under the cape of Death. It's difficult to know if Cruikshank's inclusion here of blasphemy, one of these figures towards the front is called blasphemy, represents an accurate perception of the contribution of infidelism to the reform movement. It's possible that Cruikshank's atheising of the image of radicalism was a tactical decision designed to galvanise maximum popular opposition. Whatever the reason, the fact that the ink, blasphemy, is brandishing a copy of The Age of Reason. That's called it, it's got the Age of Reason. Gives Paine's text this talismanic function. Paine's works are the emanations of his resuscitated evil spirit, which is itself a synecdoche of the Jacobin 1790s. Any viewer who doubted this typology simply had to turn back or have a look at Cruikshank's own version of the Age of Reason, which you saw at the beginning, for a full-scale demonstration of the consequences of releasing Paine's genius from the Jacobin bottle. In Cruikshank's poem, we've all seen, the dance of death is reincarnated as an English Carmagnoli. Another way to put this point, by the way, is that Cruikshank's repudiation of Richard Carlyle is itself an apostolic remedy for what he saw as a failure of Gilray, his great precursor, to deal with the threat of Thomas Paine. I'm just interested in this, yeah? Because Cruikshank is clearly Gilray, yeah? Carlyle is Paine, Cruikshank is Gilray. Closest that Gilray came to imagining Paine's death was the famous print, Tom Paine's Nightly Pest, published on the eve of Paine's trial, in absentia, of course, in December 1792. And this print, what this print does is stage itself a spectral or phantomal form of justice in the shape of a nightmarish vision in which three headless judges declare Paine's guilt. This is what they're saying, or one of them saying. No, villain, when such paltry slaves presume to mix in treason, if the plot succeeds, they're thrown neglected by. But if it fails, they're sure to die like dogs. As you should do. Now, the prints I've looked at so far, sorry, the Cruikshank prints I've looked at so far, are in fact a misleading guide, really, to his ideological affiliations in 1819. Because, of course, Cruikshank seems to have worked both sides of the political divide with breathtaking ease. That's one way to look at it. But it's true that, in fact, he was one of the radical movement's most illustrious supporters at this time. Most famously, of course, in his depiction of Peterloo. The massacre at St. Peter's, or Britain's Strike Home, and his highly successful collaboration with William Hone, the political house that Jack built. This is one of the pages of that, on the people, and you've got the Peterloo massacre in the background. In the context of Peterloo, therefore, Cruikshank's attack on Carlyle in the Age of Reason seems very ironic, because Richard Carlyle, who was at Peterloo, issued his own influential print of the debacle, and therefore became, like Cruikshank, one of the creators of Peterloo in the radical popular imagination, so they did this together. Placed alongside Cruikshank's famous depictions of mounted cavalry mowing down the people at St. Peter's Field, one way we can make sense of the Age of Reason, Death or Liberty, and other seemingly anti-radical prints, is to either conclude that Cruikshank just sold his services to the highest bidder, or to see this as Cruikshank trying to regulate and define the shape of respectable radicalism by keeping out its fringe elements, if you like, its ultra-radical elements, such as infidelity, or indeed feminism. As you know, some of you know, he also did the famous, a couple of caricatures of female reformers at this time. By the way, I've also seen one critics argue that Death or Liberty is in fact a satire on an anti-Jacobin hysteria, not that it is anti-Jacobin, it's actually a satire against that. Ironically, the phenomenal success of the political house that Jack built, 1819, prompted loyalists to attack Cruikshank and Hone as Paineite sympathisers. The cover of, for example, the Dorchester Guide, or the house that Jack built, shows the scale of justice in which the Bible outweighs, as you can see, the Age of Reason. The other book is Palmer's Principles of Nature, an American author. And, for example, this, another anti-critical house skit, adds allegorical flourishes to the same trope, the scales, by surrounding infidel texts with a monstrous hydra, a many-headed hydra, and replacing the Bible with the figure of justice on the left side there. So unwittingly, it seems, Cruikshank had furthered the notoriety of his archenemy's works. But the other striking irony of the loyalist counter-offensive against radicalism in general and infidelism in particular at this time was that, and this is where we're going to the final bit of the talk, was that the overzealous radical apotheosis of Paine gave his sacred bones to his enemies, literary on a satirical plate. Now what do I mean by this? Well, the apotheosis of Paine took a bizarrely literal twist in late 1819, the same moment of the Age of Reason. When William Cobbett returned from self-exile in America with pain in bones, I think if you know this, Cobbett was a spectacular convert to paramount wisdom. In the 1790s, of course, he'd been brilliantly anti-Jacobin and demanded, quote, an antidote to all Tom's theological and political poison. But by 1819, Cobbett, who was neither Republican nor free-thinking, had become England's leading radical journalist, and his intention was to deposit Paine's bones and his relics beneath a colossal commemorative statue. The plan for this radical pantheon never took off, though we can see a trace of it possibly in some of the imagery which Richard Carlyle put at the front of his periodical, The Days. If Carlyle's are the most sublime allegorical tributes to Paine's immortal reputation as an Enlightenment thinker, this image was actually overshadowed by Cobbett's hagiographical adventure. Cobbett's display of secular reliquary, a surreal accompaniment to Carlyle and other radicals' biographical restoration of Paine. What I mean by that is that Paine was resuscitated also by people writing his biography. This made Cobbett, unfortunately, and therefore Paine, a sitting duck for skeletonic humour. The theatricality of Cobbett's Republican Pilgrimage was caricatured by Robert Cruikshank, this is George Cruikshank's brother here, in his mock triumphal The Political Champion turned Resurrection Man. The print shows Cobbett flying back to Britain on the back of a demon, holding Paine's Bonnyroo skull like a trophy or talisman. The scene clearly echoes those caricatures I showed you, Napoleon's escape from Elba, and indeed Napoleon can be seen on the background, in the background, as a bemused spectator. But the motif of the flying demon could also be in the sardonic appropriation of Paine's comment in The Age of Reason, that quote, the resurrection and ascension, supposing them to have taken place, must have admitted of public and ocular demonstration like that of the ascension of the balloon. Robert Cruikshank also produced a companion piece to this, Radical Reformer, in which a shabbily dressed Cobbett walks down a country lane carrying a sack of correct Paine's protruding bones on his back. Paine's spectral possession of Cobbett is made clear from the words written on a sheet of paper trailing from Cobbett's pocket, which says this, "Men, since I cannot succeed in writing against man, I must follow my worthy predecessor Paine and write against God." The gallows in the background is perhaps a chilling reminder of the loyalist alternative to radical deification, and it's worth remembering that just a few years earlier, allegedly anyway, the restored Bourbon monarchy in France had exhumed the bodies of Voltaire and Rousseau from the pantheon. There's still some debate about that. Another lively attack on Cobbett took the form of a narrative series called Sketches in the Life of Billy Cobb and the Death of Tommy Paine, again without the E, of course. This series revived the imagery of the Dance of Death and showed Cobbett, rather Paine this time, going to Carlyle, in league with Death and the Devil. Cobbett's veneration of Paine, therefore, allowed loyalist caricaturists to convert radical martyrology into graveyard farce. Paine's belief, in fact, in a deistical afterlife, which he called, quote, a future existence which will take any form or manner God pleases, either with or without this body, had come back to haunt him. And this is my final point. There's one final irony in the story of Paine's resurrection and ascension. For all their prominence in his caricatures here, Paine's bones disappeared mysteriously in the 1830s. No one knows what happened to them. And this loss, I think, in a way, is a fitting conclusion to the spectralisation of his image in this period. The mystery of Paine's final resting place, like his phantom prosecutions in Britain, his miraculous escape from execution in France, and his disputes of deathbed renunciation in America, could only add to his cult status. Thank you.
Has anyone got any questions for Ian? Yeah, do you want to have a break first?
You're suggesting that Cruikshank changed his position. I mean, when in the later cartoons, the sympathetic picture of was that, are you saying that he just moved back and forth between right and left as suited him, or was that a shift in the same way that Cobbett shifted from right to left?
It's simultaneous with Cruikshank. It's astonishing that the Peter Lewis image is found. Therefore, Liberty are published within weeks of each other. And as I was, I mean, it's normally explained by the fact that, like Gilray, caricaturists, you know, could sell their services to whoever would, you know, commission them for the print. But I think what I was trying to suggest is maybe it's not that, maybe there is some consistency in Cruikshank's trying to marginalise through his hyperbolic representations. Those aspects of radicalism they didn't like, particularly infidelism and feminism. But on the other hand, Deathfall Liberty, you know, contains a whole train of demons, you know, some of which, of course, do represent some mainstream aspects of radicalism.
So it's still not clear. Yeah. You are saying that Cobbett moved from right to left.
Yeah.
Is there any indication that after doing these later Peterloo cartoons, that he then moved back and did right-wing cartoons again?
Cruikshank?
Yeah.
His most famous right-wing cartoons are these, the ones I've shown you from 1819. When he worked with Owen on the political house of Jackboards, I think he's predominantly what we would call left-wing. And the story of Cruikshank, the Regency caricaturist, ends when basically, certainly according to Robert L. Patton, who was the main biographer of Cruikshank, he was basically bought off by the government, took a big fee not to produce anymore, so by about 1822, you won't find him. As you know, Cruikshank then becomes the more respectable illustrator of Dickens and so on in the 1830s and into the 1840s, and really doesn't really want to recognise his earlier career. I mean, he basically buries it. So, but on balance, I think Cruikshank's on the left. Balance, I would say. Look at the sum total.
My question is about Holmes. This is the house that Jack built.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit more about it? I think somebody went to prison, didn't they, because of writing it? No?
I'm not aware anyone went to prison.
It was quite a violent attack on the establishment, wasn't it?
Physical House of Capital was a phenomenal success.
Yeah, but I mean, what attitude did it have?
Oh, very radical.
That's what I thought.
I mean, I definitely recommend it to you if you haven't read it.
Yeah, I have read it.
You do know it, yeah.
Yeah, I've got it, yeah. But I'm just asking a bit more about. I thought whoever wrote it, Holmes, presumably.
Holmes prosecutions were in 1817, famously, were three trials, all of which he was acquitted. There's a very good recent book on Holmes called The Laughter of Triumph by Ben Wilson. Very readable, I do recommend it to you, which goes into the trials in great detail. So Holmes' trial was in 1817. One of the issues about visual caricature as opposed to written text is it seems to be, on the whole, remarkably free from prosecution. And the explanation that people like Vic Gatterall and Ben Wilson come up with is that the government would be very, very nervous about putting an image like the Age of Reason on trial. You know what I mean? I mean, imagine what you'd have to say in order to try to prove the case. So, you know, Gatterall talks about visual graphic satire and an immunity from prosecution, which I think on the whole is true. I mean, what they got away with visual terms far exceeds what you could get away with most of the time in the written word.
Yeah.
Yeah,
David,
Matt. Yeah, the only Cruikshank I was familiar with before tonight is that Peter Lee famous print. And I've just seen that in a completely different light. And actually, I don't think there is necessarily any contradiction between the way he portrayed that and the way he portrayed some of the other things. in that I think he was lampooning the failure of the authorities to properly manage the situation at St. Peter's Fields.
Right.
And making the point that actually what you're in danger of creating is a generation of radical martyrs. You know, if you don't find some better way of managing this radical threat than wading into people on horses with swords, then you are going to create the very thing you're trying to suppress, which is actually what happened. I think that may be an analysis which enables you to see Cruikshank's position fairly consistently.
I guess it may be martyrs, but not, I mean, the general service didn't say this. Particular martyrs. I mean, Henry.
Well, it was particular martyrs. The whole situation was critically mismanaged by the Manchester militia.
Oh, sure.
And we were talking about it now, if they hadn't waited in for pretty much no good reason.
They also waited in for hatchets, which they didn't use.
So, you know, the whole situation was bad and mismanaged. I was just wondering if that was management rather than if you're an evil act. And same to the authorities, how long have you pursued radicalism in this way? You want to be successful.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. If you see the sum total of this as a call for the authorities to act, but not in that way. I agree that violence, the site of violence, you know, it escalates. I'm not right.
I think you can see it consistently. I don't know much about it, so I shouldn't really comment, but I will. We could look at it in the same light as Chomsky would say about left-wing commentators. They define the limits of left-wing criticism.
Mm-hmm.
So they, rather like the moral force people, where they marched with in step at Peterloo, the idea was that you'd have a reasonable criticism while at the same time undermining what you pretend to be your own side by being a collaborator, by defining the limits of criticism.
Mm-hmm.
That's
a comment, I think, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I think it's a good point.
Well, just because we were talking about the Clifton House that Jack built and about Cruikshank's own politics, I think that just the thing you have to be careful about here is defining radicalism. I mean, I think it's a radical trend, but it's not a Paynite trend. There's nothing remotely Paynite about it. And so, you know, Cruikshank can have a view about Payne, which is consistent with right-wing approaches, and still lambast the authorities of Manchester for what they did at Peterloo. That was an easy win. I mean, everyone was pretty outraged by that. Even the Times was outraged by that. You know, you didn't have to read The Black Dwarf to oppose it. The argument of the political house that Jack built seems to me to be a constitutional one. It's explicitly non-Paynite. But, I mean, the political house that Jack built is the English constitution. You and I, Jack, John Bull, Jane Bull, we built the house, you know, and it's been ruined and wrecked and fallen down. The wealth that lay inside the house that Jack built is Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights of 1689. Tom Paine had no time for either of those things. He thought them obstructions to liberty.
But you see, I take your point, but the way that popular culture works, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Is by appropriation and by exaggeration, by misrepresentation. Because in the skits, they, you know, again, maybe it's an easy target, but they put pain. They made pain part of the vocabulary.
Yeah. In that sense, then, you know, pain. I mean, you know, they must have been just so delighted that he went on. Not only had he written The Rights of Man and made it a Republican tract, which made it difficult for a lot of English radicals mm-hmm. to actually swallow and use, but then he comes out with The Age of Reason. there's no atheist tradition in English radical politics, you know, not a strong atheist tradition at any rate. And so, you know, it's incredibly useful to them.
We could argue about that. Because, I mean, the authorities were attempting to nip it in the bud as soon as it appeared. I mean, Age of Reason was a popular book, but it was immediately outlawed.
Yes.
And if Carlyle's figures are correct, I'm not saying it was mainstream, I've never said it was mainstream, I don't think, but if he was correct in his kinds of figures and the kind of publicity he got, you know, there was a substantial kind of readership out there. Difficult to know.
There's a very large readership for The Rights of Man, but I think what happens is that people they cherry pick the bits that they can absorb. You know, there's a kind of a rampant anti-clericalism amongst radicals, which isn't necessarily, and it's a deism amongst radicals, which isn't necessarily an atheism. So it's a question of where you.
Well, Paine's not an atheist.
No, he's not.
No, but his book is represented.
Ah, well, that's back to this idea, isn't it? If we're talking about the actual text as opposed to misrepresentation, Paine is a deist. I mean, when it becomes. By the way, the word infidel tends to mean when deism becomes popular. I mean, Ian McCalman is the expert on this. I think Ian McCalman has argued, doesn't he, in several places, particularly in his book Radical Underworld, that there was a significant strand of at least deism or infidelism, if not atheism, in the radical movement. And maybe, I mean, I guess this debate, this is my attempt to just stick my oar into that debate. I'm not, you know, the foremost expert. But I think, you know, the hysteria generated, as soon as Paine pops up anywhere, the Paine of the Age of Reason, I think, is potentially more radical and dangerous than the Paine of the Age, the Paine of the Rights of Man. And in a way, that's just, I want to just correct, you know, get a more balanced picture of Paine's place, really, his presence in the political imagination and in popular culture at this time.
When you mention the word Jacobite, what do you mean by that?
Jacobin. Well, I mean, again, Jacobin has tended to become a shorthand word for an extreme revolutionary position. That, again, it's like many of these terms, it's partly the creation of radicals and largely the creation of anti-radicals. You know, it gets appropriated mainly by the establishment, and Jacobin becomes a negative term, as in the Anti-Jacobin, which was the title of a famous journal from the late 1790s. So, and of course, Burke, in his famous tract on the regicide peace. So, you know, people will read Burke's book on the French Revolution, Reflections on the French Revolution, and talk about its representation of Jacobinism. And of course, strictly Jacobinism wasn't really on the scene, you know, until 1793-4, was it, when it was actually in power in the French Terror. So it's the way the French Terror tended to colour the whole kind of discourse of French revolutionary politics. So if you were a Jacobin sympathiser, that was a dangerous position to be in, whether you were or not, of course.
Okay, one last question.
Were these pictures, where were they published, and did people have to pay for them, or were they given away free, or how did they produce them?
Well, this is a very, I'm glad you mentioned this point. The popularity of caricature is a crucial issue, you know, if you're talking about its impact. single print graphic satire in a black and white usually cost between sixpence and a shilling if you wanted to actually buy one. If you wanted a coloured one, and it's amazing how many of these coloured impressions are still around, isn't it? They could cost as much as a guinea. Yeah. However, as many of you might know, they were also displayed in shop windows, the shop windows of the caricature retailers. And so in that sense, you could go and look at them for free in shop windows, as indeed people did. And Gilray, for example, and a number of caricaturists make the scene outside the caricature shop a caricature. It becomes a kind of subgenre in its own right. You could also borrow them, rather like borrowing a video or something. You know, you could kind of rent them for the night in sheets, you know, collections of them, and then hand them round at your party or wherever you were. So it's very hard to be precise about, you know, the actual popularity. But, I mean, most people who write about caricature will present reasonably convincing evidence that they reached a wide audience and they had some penetration down to the lower classes. Now, things like these kinds of pamphlets, of course, were only, I can't remember the exact price of the Chichikov House of Jack, but it was very cheap and would certainly be passed around among radical associations and clubs. And so, of course, the loyalists answered Tom Paine with the cheap repository tracts in the 1790s, many of which were distributed for free. Actually, for free. The circulation of Hannah More's tracts, as far as we know, outstripped anything that Thomas Paine ever did. However, the figures for Hannah More's tracts come from Hannah More herself. So, again, it's hard to know, isn't it? It's very, very hard to know. William?
Check Elsie's.
How was he published?
How was he distributed? Was it in single images that were sold?
The single print happens, except for things like The Political House, you see, which is actually a pamphlet, sorry, which I'm sure, you know, I should know the price. It was no more than sixpence. Might have been less. Of course, this whole tradition runs out by the 1820s, and by the 1830s and 1840s, the caricature becomes part of print culture. It moves into inside periodicals. So the great age of the single print caricature is the Romantic period.
Yeah. Right, well, we're going to stick the heating on now. If you'd like to stay around and buy some beer or some books, that would help us, because that's essentially how we fund ourselves. But thank you very much
for
coming on to speak to us.